And we are now live.
All right. Well, thank you. Welcome, everybody, to the LTD ATU Pension Trust, February 15th at 11 a.m. We'll start the meeting off with a roll call of trustees. So I'll just go through the list and just say hi if you're here and silence if you're not. So Mr. John Gangle, you'll be showing up late. Mr. Frederick Casey.
I'm here.
All right. Ms. Christina Hsu.
Good morning, Bill.
Mr. Mark Johnson.
I am here.
Okay. And Ms. Michelle Weber. I hear she's going to show up a little late, too. We have our presenters here. They're listed on the agenda for anybody interested. But I'll start with preliminary remarks. Welcome everybody to doing this work. I just want to say I appreciate everybody coming in together. These times of the year when we get to talk about our retirement system for our workers. It's a critical role that we all do wearing this hat. And I do know that in the end, our members do appreciate all the effort that we put in the interim. It's a benefit that they hold near and dear, and it keeps me motivated to keep it up and do good work when we're in here. So I just want to say that, just setting the stage for our meeting. I don't have any additions to the agenda, but I'll open the floor to our trustees to see if anybody else has any additions to the agenda.
None here.
Okay. Doesn't look like any additions. We'll give a chance for audience participation. I won't read it unless there is somebody that's willing to participate. So Camille, can you check on that for us?
I am not showing any public attendees at all.
I thought as well. So, okay, we're just speedy. What's that?
At first I thought I saw you talking, but then I didn't hear your voice. So I thought something was going on technically, but that's not true.
So we had meeting minutes that were provided as a handout. If anybody has any comments or questions about the meeting minutes, now would be the time to talk about them before we put forward a motion to approve them. So did everybody get a chance to look through the meeting minutes? And if you found no fault with them, I'll entertain a motion to approve the meeting minutes.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
I will second.
Okay. It's been moved by Mark Johnson, seconded by Christina. Any further discussion on the minutes? Nope. Okay. So we'll go through a roll call vote of the meeting minutes. I'll start with myself. Aye. Ms. Christina Hsu.
Aye.
Mr. Johnson?
I'm an aye.
Okay. Fred Casey?
Aye.
Aye. And our other participants haven't shown up yet, but that moves it forward. So minutes are approved. And we'll move on to our next agenda item. And we have information for the meeting, report of the investment consultant, Ian.
All right, thanks, Bill. Would everybody like me to share my screen? Is that probably most helpful?
Yes.
Okay,
pull that up for everybody. Somebody could give me a verbal cue when that's up on the screen.
Looks good to me.
All right. So quick capital markets update here through the end of the year. Obviously a little bit different environment that we ended the year on than what we've started this year on. So keep that in mind in terms of what kind of performance numbers we're looking at. These were cut at December 31st, 2021. So just to put some of those remarks in context or plan performance in context, it really was a pretty strong Q4, if you recall. Q3 was relatively flat following the first two quarters of the year that were you know, highly positive over most risk assets, at least, so public equities, namely. But you can see in that bottom left-hand box here, S&P 500 was up very strong for the quarter at 11%, which left us at a year-to-date return at just sub of 29%. So another stellar year for U.S. equities in general. Smaller cap companies, as represented by that second line down, the Russell 2000, lagged their large cap counterparts slightly, but was still positive, very positive in terms of absolute perspective, up a little bit shy of 15%. And then we had international equities with a pretty strong year as well. You know, it, you know, when you take it and look at it next to the S&P 500, it may not look terribly great compared to that, but it was still really positive with about a 10 to 11% return, depending on the market segment of international developed equities. Really the only portion of public equities that didn't do great in 2021 was emerging market equities. You know, we've got some exposure to that in our international mandates, but not any true dedicated exposure there. You know, it's interesting to talk about the dynamics of those in terms of forward-looking returns. Emerging market equities actually look fairly attractive right now compared to particularly U.S. equities, which are, you know, with valuations in very sky-high territory right now. But, you know, that being said, it was overall a pretty strong year for any plan that had meaningful allocations to public equities, particularly any U.S. equity overweight. Bonds were slightly negative from an index perspective. So you can see there the Bloomberg US Ag Bond Index was down about 1.5% for the year, primarily due to a slight increase in interest rates over the course of the year. You know, if you draw your attention to the bottom right chart, that Treasury yield curve, you can notice that yellow line is where the Treasury yield curve sat at the end of 2020. The green line is where it sat at the end of 2021. So again, not a lot of movement on the front end of the curve. Obviously, there probably will be this year with you know, Fed expectations or expectations of the Fed to, you know, try to get that back up to some normalized level to combat inflation to some degree. But you know, over the course of the year, particularly in Q4, you know, you saw interest rates increase a bit over the course of that quarter in anticipation of some of that potential interest rate movements here in 2022. So overall, that left fixed income from an index perspective slightly down. We'll look how this plan's performance did versus the benchmark, which was quite a bit better. And that's where active management has really been shown to do fairly well lately is versus that Bloomberg Ag Bond Index. But that being said, from just a markets perspective, slightly negative for bonds. You know, really outside of that, the other strong performers of 2021 were anything real estate related. So REITs and or core real estate. Those were two segments that also had really great years alongside of large cap US equities. So what are some of the things that drove that during the year? Well, obviously, increased easing from the Fed. We had interest rates continue to stay very low. Federal funds rate did not move during 2021. It was basically held at zero. And we had quantitative easing metrics for most of the year, with that slightly being pulled back toward the end of the year, but meaningfully the entire year was fairly easy from a monetary perspective, as well as from a fiscal perspective. So that drove a lot of money into riskier asset classes that tend to do better under those conditions. And we saw that that theme that was very similar to 2020, if you remember, play out again in 2021. Now, looking forward, you know, I think we're probably under a whole new paradigm going forward. We're getting inflation prints that are the biggest that we've seen in 30, 40 years. The Fed has a tough task ahead of them in terms of trying to combat that inflation with the tools that are at their disposal, basically interest rates, but trying to do that at a pace and at a level that is not going to drastically halt any economic growth. So it's a tough spot to be at right now. We've got to try to get inflation under control. There's a lot of debate about whether that can be reined in as effectively as it was in the 70s by simply just increasing interest rates, because we've got a lot of other dynamics going on that were caused by the pandemic in terms of supply and demand imbalances and things that aren't necessarily exactly tied to interest rate movements. So we'll see what the next, you know, four quarters this year has to bring in terms of trying to get that down, those inflation numbers down, but try to keep the economy moving along and not put the skids entirely on it as we exit, hopefully, this kind of post-pandemic period that we're likely going to see in 2022. If not completely exiting the pandemic period, probably exiting it to some degree, at least larger than we have in 2021, where most things were fairly still closed up from an economic standpoint. So maybe with that, I'll open it up. Are there any trustee questions with respect to capital markets, either rearview mirror looking in 2021 or looking forward with respect to 2022? Okay, hearing none, I'm going to jump a few pages forward to page, what I believe is 14 of 69 in our committee packet deck. So that'll be the page number that I reference. You can see here from the, if we just focus our attention on that very bottom box for right now, you know, another really great year in terms of asset class returns. We had the plan start at a value of at about just shy of 37 million, and we ended the year just a bit above 41 million. So a $4 million ish gain for the calendar year. You know, recall that comes on the heels of 2020, where we saw about a $4.8 million gain. So we're up about $9 million or so without any meaningful cash flows in or out of the plan over those 2 years. So, you know, we've seen some really great performance in these markets over the past 2 years. It's something that we all should be proud of, but we should all be thinking about what potentially shifts could potentially need to be made going forward, given that we're probably exiting some of the extremely high 20 to 30% asset returns that we've been kind of grown to accustomed to over the past couple of years. You know, most of us are not forecasting this kind of stellar performance going forward under these new conditions. But that being said, for 2021, an amazing year, up $4 million for the plan. And you can see the asset classes above in the red bars. That just showcases the differences versus our target. A bit overweight domestic equity to end the year, not unsurprising, given how much better domestic equity did than most of its other counterpart asset classes, but still well within policy bands. So no concerns there. You know, realistically, we had to take a look at this today. That's probably reined in quite a bit. International equity has done a bit better than U.S. equity this year to start 2022. So I would expect those deviations in target versus actual weightings to minimize the bid if we were going to look at that today, but still no issues in terms of where the asset classes sit versus their target for the end of the year. I'm going to move a few pages ahead to page 18. So here we can see total plan performance and most of the composite performance. This is gross of fees, this first cut. We can take a deeper dive into net of fees performance here in a second. We look at gross of fees first as a reminder, everybody, because we only get other plan performance reported in gross of fees very reliably at this point. So we usually rank total fund performance versus your peer group at a gross of fees basis, and then we'll take a look at net of fees performance, which is what we really care about when we look at some of the underlying composite performance. But, you know, for the year-to-date period, still ranked above median. We were about in the 43rd percentile of peers, so outperformed the majority of your peers in that under $100 million peer group. You know, we well outperformed the policy benchmark. So, you know, three really great positives to take from that. One, the most important thing we care about, we had a really great absolute return, up about just shy of 12% for the year on a gross of fees basis. Two, we outperformed our policy benchmark. So that means the underlying managers and underlying structure of the funds versus our policy weightings and policy benchmarks added value. And three, another positive, outperformed peers. I rank those somewhat in order of what I would consider importance. But again, really strong year. If you look over those longer term periods, you know, we're well outperforming our investment return assumption over every single time period, going back 10 years, and meaningfully outperforming the policy benchmark. And over pretty longer periods of time, you know, you look at that 3, 5, 7, 10 year period, really ranking in about the top third, sometimes even in the top quarter of peers. So it's been a really good, you know, post GFC period for this plan. We've made back a lot of ground in terms of, you know, funding. So I think this is something that we can all take a look at. And I do view this as some kind of a shift point, because I think going forward, we're likely to enter the next, you know, few years that our markets are going to give us a lot different of a flavor than they probably have been giving us for the previous few years. You know, that being said, we should hang our hats on some good performance when we potentially can. And a lot of those movements, a lot of those things that probably seem insignificant along the way that we've done in terms of rebalancing or adjusting targets slightly or manager changes, they've all added value collectively over the past few years. And I think that's something that we can all be proud of. A couple pages further, page 20. So this is what we really care about, right? So this is net of fees performance. So obviously performance streams after underlying fees to investment managers have been paid. So total fund up about 11.25%. We saw that, you know, most notably be driven by strong equity returns, as we discussed in the capital markets section, particularly domestic equity. But also some pretty strong returns from some other asset classes like international equity and real return. And, you know, if you recall, real return is one of those things about this time last year, technically at our next meeting, I think that's when we normally look at asset allocation. That was the time we took a look at real return and we bumped that up by a few percentage points to, you know, try to provide some meaningful inflation protection to the portfolio. Most of that's going to come from that real return allocation. So in times of, you know, higher inflation and continued higher inflation, particularly even in times when interest rates might be rising, which we were likely to go into, you know, I expect that real return allocation to provide some of that inflation hedging that we're likely not going to get through traditional asset classes like U.S. equities and fixed income that technically don't do quite well from a real return perspective during those environments. So I think it was prudent and smart of us to up that allocation about a year ago. And that definitely provided some positive returns to the plan in 2021, with real return being up about 14%. If we look on starting on page 21, this is gonna go over the underlying investment managers. It was a mixed year. You know, we had some real positive performance from a certain group of managers, and we had a couple outstanding managers that didn't do quite as well. You know, the ones that stick out that did really well for the year was Dodge & Cox. They were up just shy of 32% for the year, well outperforming their benchmark by about 650 basis points, ranked in the fifth percentile of like large cap value funds. So that truly has been, if you look over the entire history of that investment manager, even, you know, out to the time periods we really care about, that 3, 5, 7 time period, you know, they've ranked amazingly versus their peers. Harbor Cap was one that had a pretty difficult year, you know, on a relative basis. You know, they were still up 16%. So it's hard to say that anything up 16% did terrible, but it did underperform its primary benchmark by about 12% for the year. I will say this is one of those segments that not a lot of active large cap managers did very well in 2021. You can see that actually from where the peer median ranks versus the index. So even if you draw your attention on that calendar year to date section that I'm circling right here, you can see even the peer median, so where the 50th percentile manager ranked, still underperformed the benchmark by about 5.5% or so. It was a tough year for large cap growth managers. There were a few names in there that made a lot of noise on the positive side and a few names that made a lot of noise on the negative side. So if you look under the hood of that Russell 1000 growth index, you had some performers that were up huge, 50% for the year, 60% for the year. And you had some fairly significant companies that were down 30, 40% for the year that had some pretty big earnings misses. You know, that's probably, you know, even if you look at this year in 2022, I'm sure you all saw the news about Facebook missing their earnings and wiping out like a quarter of their valuation in one single day by one earnings miss. That was obviously a very big exposure that made the news, but there were a select few of those that happened throughout 2021 as well, with some not quite as big a names. But if you had exposure to a few of those, even just one or two of those in your portfolio, you meaningfully underperformed that benchmark. So HarborCap, not a great year. You know, they are technically coming off a really, really good last couple of years, so hard to ding them too much. They still rank really well over the long term versus their peer group. So no large concerns on our end, other than, you know, kind of a one big hiccup year. Outside of that, LSV had a really good year. They were up 240 basis points on their benchmark. They basically actually balanced out American Funds growth, which was underperformed by a similar amount. So some good diversification benefits from there. But we didn't get a lot of positive alpha from our international equity portfolio because of that. On the next page, I think kind of the biggest two standouts on this page are, you know, DoubleLine did a really good job. Recall that's our active portion of our fixed income composite, the Vanguard Total Bond being the passive piece of it. So really we use that Vanguard Total Bond Fund to kind of lower overall plan fees, but obviously meant to track the benchmark. As we discussed in capital market segment, we know that that benchmark did not do terribly great this year, down about 150 basis points or so. But DoubleLine did a pretty good job of managing duration risk and credit risk over the year, investing in a few places that have a little bit higher yielding segments than that benchmark did. And it made up a pretty good amount of ground there. So our fixed income composite did it pretty well in positive territory for 2021. The other piece I'd probably highlight is that PIMCO inflation response. You know, that's the sole component of that real return portfolio that we've got there. You know, that's what's housing things like TIPS exposure, REITs exposure, natural resource equities, some commodities exposure, things that are meant to do well in inflationary times or high inflationary times or increasing inflationary times, which we definitely are in right now. And you saw some pretty strong performance, up about 14% there for that allocation. So I'll probably wrap up my comments there with respect to managers and individually, but it was a mixed bag this year. We did outperform collectively from the policy index, so that's really what matters overall. You know, if we probably had a couple of those individual circumstances that would have done maybe a little bit better versus their respective benchmark, we probably would have outperformed by quite a bit. But that being said, overall, still a very strong year from my perspective. With that, any questions on managers in particular, or anything to do with plan performance?
Ian, thank you so very much for this. One thing you mentioned was that we will be, I think, looking at the changes to the allocation or revisiting the target allocations, I think, next time. And you also mentioned that we're in a sort of a transitionary period. So are there things that you would like for us as trustees to be thinking about between now and the next meeting with regards to that transition and the what you'll be bringing forward to us with regards to the target allocations?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think that, you know, something that you can think about is, and this will be a great discussion to have in conjunction with your actuaries here from Milliman, is to think about, you know, where the plan funding now sits versus where it did a couple of years ago. Is the risk profile still correct for a plan that's a bit more well off now than we were a few years ago? Is there an opportunity to or a need? I mean, I'm not necessarily advocating for any of these. These are just open-ended questions. Is there an appetite or need to de-risk the plan at all? You know, this is you know, different than a lot of plans. It's not closed, so we're not thinking about, you know, a definite finite end to it per se. But, you know, these are all questions we got to think about. Asset returns, you know, we're just finishing up our capital market assumptions process that we do every year. And unsurprisingly, you know, equity returns, forecasted equity returns are coming down after another great year. Valuations are extremely high. We did last year, I think, make a prudent shift to recognize that. And so we shifted a little bit out of U.S. equity and a little bit more into international equity to represent or to recognize, some of those valuation differences going forward. So I think that's something that we've got to continue to look at, where the expected return and risk profile of this particular target allocation is coming in versus where you all decide to continually set that discount rate and think about what our probability is of hitting that under this circumstances, or do we still have a meaningful way of hitting that under a different asset allocation? These are all things we'll explore at the next meeting. You know, it's, I know the markets haven't looked great this year, but it's important to keep in mind a longer term perspective. Yeah, markets are down, you know, somewhere between 5% and 8% this year so far, depending on what asset classes you look at and what mixes you look at. You know, that being said, it really doesn't even take us down to where we were, you know, not that long ago. So it's good to keep a longer term perspective in mind when we look at some of those, you know, shorter time periods of returns versus kind of what we've experienced over the last 5 to 7 years in terms of asset growth. So I know that's probably a long-winded way of explaining your question, Christina. I don't have any firm recommendations yet, but as soon as I start doing the asset class modeling, which we just wrapped up our assumptions in the last week or two, so I'm just getting started on that, I'll have a lot more firm things to discuss at the next meeting. But I think these are key themes to keep in mind when we go through some of the actuarial exercises and thinking about where we need to get to and how we want to get to that point.
Thank you so very much.
Bill, it looked like you had something. So you got something for me? You might be on mute. I'm not sure.
Is this sounding good?
Yep.
Okay. If you're going to be doing some of that capital markets review and maybe thinking about proposing changes, a pullback on equities or moving things around, the sooner you can get us that information so we can start to review it and wrap our heads around it, if there's going to be some shifts that maybe could be a short-term play or a long-term play, but however you want to frame it, if we get the information in advance, I think that'd be great.
Perfect. Yeah. And I would say that I don't anticipate anything big, if anything. I mean, we just kind of locked in that asset allocation this time last year. I think it's still probably pretty prudent. So my gut is telling me right now there's likely not going to be much we need to do, if anything. Understanding that, you know, we can't completely abandon equities just because the outlook for them doesn't look extremely favorable right now. You know, we're not a group that's trying to make large scale tactical movements here. We're trying to be prudent about this thing for a very long period of time and slowly increase that funding percentage over time. You know, but there are some potential things we could consider, depending on the conversations you have around discount rate and things like that. So all things to keep in mind, but certainly hear you, Bill. If I see anything that's glaring, I'll certainly try to get that to everybody, at least a few weeks ahead of the meeting day.
Appreciate that. Any other questions for Ian from?
One quick one. Ian, given what you talk about being the long-term view and stuff, does that mean that we don't need to consider some of the things you mentioned, like the inflation or your yield curve, going down and things like that? Are those things that, because it's a long-term thinking, we don't need to, we shouldn't be trying to necessarily do any shifts related to those things, but more your strategy is, I guess, the things that you already talked to us about?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to think about it. It's really kind of a large philosophy type question with a pension plan. You know, you've got different ways of attacking what you would consider short-term market imbalances versus long-term market trends. You know, really where we're hoping to get, maybe strong yield curve plays, for example. That's not something we're trying to make as a committee, but that's something we're expecting Double Line to make, for example. Like, we're expecting them to say, okay, we're entering a time period of increasing interest rates potentially. That probably means I want less duration than the benchmark because I want less interest rate sensitivity. That might mean that more, defaults are coming up. So I want to have a higher credit quality than the benchmark, or, those are some of the tactical movements that we're not necessarily equipped to make here because we're not controlling security selection, but we're highly expecting some of those active managers to add value there. You know, and that's why we've got Double Line sized the way we do versus the passive benchmark. So those are the kind of things that might be something to think about as sizing between managers, for example, under certain market circumstances. But in terms of saying, well, just because equity expectations have come down, which they're going to, and fixed income assumptions are marginally going to move up, remember, these are 20-year views of what asset class returns are supposed to be. We're certainly not making estimates about what we think the market's going to do in any given 1 year or even 5 year period. So we have to take all these trends into mind when we're thinking about what's the long-term goal. The long-term goal is to fully fund the plan prudently without taking on too much investment risk. I still think that we've got an asset allocation that is prudently going to get us there without taking on too much risk. But if the committee, for example, decided to say, well, we can afford to, this is a hypothetical point, but you can contribute a large amount of capital to the plan today. If you think of a hypothetical company that did really well in any given 1 year and says, hey, we just want to throw a lot of this money at our pension fund, try to fully fund it, that changes the dynamic of the conversation, because now you're not needing to have a return profile or risk profile that's needed to bridge that gap as much. It was done through funding. So things like that can drastically change the course of a pension fund if outside dynamics happen like that. But just minor changes to the capital markets, which we've seen lately, minor changes, they're not large scale changes. Minor changes to capital markets usually don't warrant large changes to asset allocation. So that's generally, I think, the answer to your question is we'll take a look at the new asset class assumptions. We'll look at where, our expected or our discount rate is set. We'll think about if there's any shifts that make sense to the plan. But my gut would tell me that, we've made some minor shifts in the past year that are likely still in strong favor going forward. And I don't see meaningful changes potentially to that going forward, unless we make some small tweaks to maybe manager sizing and things like that.
Thank you, Ian. That was really very helpful. Thank you.
Bill, unless there's some specific questions, that probably does it for me. But I'm happy to answer any other questions that trustees have. If not, I can pass the torch to the next presenter.
Okay. Am I coming in clear for everybody this time?
You are.
All right. Well, that's great. I guess I'll just do one last look around at the trustees, and even if a panelist guest wanted to have a comment, otherwise we'll move on to the report of the actuary. Seeing none, we're going to call up Scott and Lacey.
All right. Thanks, Bill. I'm going to share my screen. And can you confirm if you can see that letter for me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So I'll start off. Lacey will jump in here before too long. And I'll walk through sort of the intro of this letter. Just for reference, there's no formal decision needed today. This is really background information. And then at the next meeting, we'll be at the spot where we'd be looking for final adoption of the assumptions underlying our work for the January 1, 2022 valuation. So the letter on the screen here really talks through some of the underlying assumptions that go into that valuation. Kind of for background, the previous published valuation was at the beginning of 2020. Lots happened since then, clearly, but we do every 2-year valuations, and this one that we're working on in the coming months will determine the contribution rates for the fiscal year starting the 22-23 and the 23-24. So it's set 2 years at a time as far as kind of fiscal year contributions. Tying into stuff Ian just covered, one of the big things that's happened in the last 2 years is really good asset returns. And so that's great. And you'll see that asset gain in the way it comes through in our valuation. We smooth it a little bit so it doesn't come through, you know, all at once. So there's a little bit of a pent-up gain that gets saved and sort of set aside for future valuations in what we call the actuarial value of assets. But the other thing that does is, following up on Ian's point about forward-looking expectations being lower now because we've had a run-up. And so that's the biggest assumption that affects the valuation. And so we'll get to that and spend more time on that than probably the other assumptions. But just for context, that's where we've had a good gain relative to the current 5.75 investment return assumption over the last 2 years. But that actually maybe, you know, makes it harder to expect that going forward. And do please feel free to jump in with questions along the way, wherever you may like to. The first assumption was going to touch on our hours, which goes into the contribution rate we determine for the what's called the normal cost, the value of new benefits being accrued in a year. At the 2020 valuation, we assumed 510,000 hours per year. In actuality, going through pandemic and everything else the last 2 years, we had a lower hour count than that in 2020. 2021, as shown there, had rebounded quite a bit up to 495,000 hours. From the data we've received so far at the start of this year, we were just about up to the same sort of headcount that we had 2 years ago. So 238 actives is, I think, what we have as the preliminary number at our kind of snapshot date for the valuation. That equates, with that current assumption of 510,000 hours, that equates to 2,100, 2,150 hours per person, kind of reasonable versus what we've seen in the past. So at the moment, and again, would welcome input on this between now and, you know, sort of the final valuation that we prepare closer to the May timing this year. But at the moment, we think that 510,000 hour assumption is pretty reasonable. Things were coming back up to that level. I know Christina has kind of, we reached out before this and she'd let us know that there were even some planning projections that it might go higher, but this is something where being a little lower is conservative as far as the way we set that normal cost rate. And we do want it to tie to the headcount we actually have in the valuation. So if it were to increase over the next 2 years, but that comes from more people coming in, we wouldn't necessarily want to get out in front of that because we're setting our valuation and the costs that tie to this based on the snapshot date. So we do want those to stay in line.
And Scott,
go ahead.
That headcount number and the hours number, the plan's less sensitive to that now than it was a few years ago, because we did change the payment for the unfunded liability to a fixed cost versus the ongoing benefit.
Exactly. So that's a very good point. This used to be something that was more critical because it affected not just the normal cost, the cost of benefits being accrued, but also the way that we paid off the amortization of the unfunded. And since we divorced those pieces and made the amortization of the unfunded kind of independent from the hours, this is a lot lower stakes, if you will, if we were a little higher, a little low on this. And you'll see that broken out at the exhibit at the back of this when Lacey walks through kind of the details of those two parts of the contribution. Okay. Other quick hit assumption before we get into the investment return one, which is, again, the most impactful. But mortality assumption for our valuation, we look at this every couple of years and try to keep it current. There haven't been any dramatic changes in the standard tables that have been published since the valuation 2 years ago. We picked one that sort of best fits the expectation of this population, recognizing that, you know, this plan isn't big enough to really set mortality experience just based on its own retirees. You know, 250 retirees is nowhere near what you could really judge. You're going to have ups and down years on a population that size. But so we have what we think is a good, what's called here, the PRI 2012 blue collar table that was published by the Society of Actuaries to fit this kind of population. And all we're doing now is keeping in line with every year they publish updates to their projection of like how to continue that out into the future. And those go up and down just depending on results of the, you know, sort of the intervening period. And what we're suggesting is bringing that up to really the latest and greatest, what's called the MP mortality projection scale from 2021. It just so happens that that ticks down the future life expectancy slightly, you know, by 0.1 of a year in the table that you'll see there. That's not really anything COVID related. That's not yet into this data yet because it kind of works on a lag. And the long-term expectation coming out of COVID is still a little bit up in the air. Clearly there, you know, there's been excess mortality in the last couple of years, but what that means for the forward-looking trend is, you know, there's kind of arguments in both directions on how that will play out. So I'll pause. Any questions there? That's really, in the grand scheme of things, this update is really minor in the liabilities, but we do just like to keep it current. Okay. All right. The valuation investment return assumption. So this one, 2 years ago, trustees lowered this significantly from 6.5% to 5.75% with that last valuation, reflecting the way that forward-looking expectations had dropped at that time. And, you know, now we're in a spot where even that 5.75 is higher than a lot of forward-looking expectations because of the, you know, returns of the last couple of years, the kind of high PE ratios on equities like Ian was talking about, and sort of the general continued trend in that direction. So what we've done is refreshed our analysis that looks at, given the asset allocation, and I know, you know, as Ian mentioned, this could change in the coming months, but it may not change the picture dramatically. Based on the current asset allocation, we ran that through models both created by our colleagues within Milliman, who kind of are focused on the capital market outlooks, through information. We're sharing information Ian gave us on RVK's kind of most current capital market assumptions. And then also through a survey, what's called a Horizon survey, that looks at assumptions from 39 different investment advisors, including, I think, RVK's in there. I know Milliman's in there a lot, kind of contribute to that to get sort of a, you know, an average of outlooks, and then say, you know, what does that do at the sort of the median, the 50th percentile of the distribution, what comes out of those various different models. So that's what's shown here on the table at the top of page 3. given the plan's current asset allocation. We show two different numbers from Milliman, a 10-year that's at 4.78 and a 20-year that's at 5.59, because our colleagues built kind of a couple different versions of this model, one that's more driven by near-term pricing and expectations and inflation, and one that's a little bit more of a longer-term reversion to mean to show the way they sort of see that potentially playing out. And then RVK's number was a little bit below 5% at the median, with an inflation built in there of a little below 2.5% over the next, I believe that was a 20-year timeframe you indicated, Ian, right?
Yeah, it is.
Is that correct? Okay. And then that horizon survey, the kind of survey of different assumptions, was at 5.14%. So, you know, all four numbers here currently varying degrees below the 5.75 previous assumption. When we did this 2 years ago, I think the horizon assumption was 5.8 or 5.9. So it was a little bit above where the trustees landed. And so that just shows the kind of continued downward march of where expectations are.
Scott, if I may,
yeah,
you know, that horizon number is a year stale now. So, you know, because they haven't come out with the newest one since all of us are just coming up with our assumptions. Mm-hmm. So just to put a little flavor on it, I'd be shocked if that horizon number didn't come down a little bit with the new 2022 survey as well. So again, it probably wouldn't change it drastically, but just to put that in context.
No, that's true. They always publish this in summer. So this one came out maybe in August. And depending on, you know, when the different investment shops kind of prepare their results, there's something usually from either, you know, sort of were developed in the start of the year or into, you know, end of Q1, start of Q2, usually by the time they go to horizon. So yeah, I'd agree. If the trend, the downward trend, we may continue to see in Horizon's next version of this, though their inflation could bump up a little bit too, since things have been moving that way. All right. So I do think it's always important to bear in mind, and we'll get to the back here, we'll get to what a few different kind of benchmarks of the current 5.75 or lower assumptions do to the investments, in the investment return due to the contribution rates and funded status measures that we look at in the valuation. It is good to have in context that the gains that you've had from the last couple of years of good investment returns mean that if you do choose to lower the investment, forward-looking investment return, and get more conservative on that front, you're kind of taking some of the gains that you've had, and you still may end up with a lower contribution, even with a more conservative interest rate, because you've got those offsetting gains. So you can kind of spend some of those gains on getting more conservative on the assumption, even without changing the profile of the contribution pattern dramatically, for example. So we'll get to that at the exhibit at the back, but just for a preview of that. Long-term, I do think it's important to keep in mind that whatever trustees chooses an assumption here, you know, it doesn't govern what the plan will actually earn. If you could govern what the plan would actually earn, we would encourage you to choose a high number, but that's not the way this works. We're choosing an expectation of what we want to plan around. And then if you're a little higher on that expectation, you may be more likely to end up with losses in the future that then get paid through the amortization method that the plan has, which is a, you know, responsive and appropriate policy. So it will get paid back. But if you set this more conservative, you're maybe more likely to get surprised by gains rather than losses in the future. So that's kind of the, you know, set this dial somewhere that's a reasonable assumption, and then have appropriate policies in place to deal with the gains or losses that inevitably will come year to year and biennium to biennium on this. Okay. Then just before I turn this over to Lacey to walk through sort of what this means for the valuation, I just did want to say where we're at right now in the process. We're still collecting some of the data we need for the actual 1/1/2022 valuation. So these results are preliminary. When we come back in May or whenever the next meeting will be, you know, the numbers will change a little bit once we get final census data and retiree data and everything. but this is meant to be indicative of really what the different assumption sets look like and where it pushes. So the actual numbers may move up or down a little bit depending on gains or losses that we see come through in that. But that's sort of the spirit in which to take the results here or in the next couple pages. Okay. If there's no questions, I'll jump to the exhibit one and Lacey can walk us through it.
Thanks, Scott. So what we've got here, excuse me, are our preliminary, so basically projected valuation results. Like Scott said, this doesn't reflect any actual changes to the plan population over the last 2 years, even though we know those are coming. They're just not available usually this early in the year. So these, you'll see similar numbers hopefully at the next meeting, but keep in mind that these are not final. And so the actual contribution that we recommend and the actual final accrued liability is going to be a little different depending on the census data and depending on the final assumptions that the trustees select at the next meeting. So we've heard a lot about assets already today, but just as a reminder, the market value of assets has increased almost $10 million over the last 2 years, which is a great financial position for the plan to be in. Scott mentioned that we smoothed the assets over a 2-year period, so that actuarial value of assets is a little lower than the market value of assets. So as of the beginning of this year, our market value was about $42.2 million. And once we smooth those assets and the returns over the last 2 years, our actuarial value of assets is the 39.7 there at the top of that first chart on the right. So that's the number we'll use in the valuation and that you'll see repeated in the table below. And that's the one that we use to determine the deficit of the plan as well as the funded ratio of the plan. So as a reminder where we were coming from in the 2020 valuation, the plan had liabilities of about 47 million, assets of just under 32 million, which gave us a deficit of a little more than 15 million as of 2 years ago, and a funded percentage of 68%. If we fast forward over the next 2 years without changing any assumptions, and again, without reflecting changes in the plan population, the liability does go up as we would expect over a couple years. And the actuarial value of assets has increased quite significantly as well. So that all else being the same means that the deficit is much smaller, almost $5.5 million smaller than it was 2 years ago. And the funded ratio improves to 80%. Now, again, that doesn't reflect any assumption changes or any changes to the population. So from here, the next three columns present basically three different scenarios based on the assumption changes that Scott discussed. The mortality change is really very, very small. So we've lumped that in here in that middle column, the 5.5% column. So that one reflects updating the mortality assumption as well as lowering the assumed rate of return from 5.25% to 5.5%. We've shown the three different scenarios here, each dropping down by 25 basis points. And basically each step there increases the liability by about $1.3 million. And so the same impact happens on the deficit. The plan deficit increases the same amount as the liability does. It also means a slightly lower funded ratio, so about 2% for each one of those steps that you take down in the assumed rate of return. The other big number that we care about from the valuation is, of course, the contribution. So Scott, if you'll switch to the next page, we can talk about what those assumption changes mean for the expected contribution. So again, rewinding to where we were 2 years ago, we were expecting the contribution to be about $3.8 million. And Bill, like you mentioned earlier, that is primarily two pieces, the normal cost contribution and the amortization payment. And those were split 2 years ago. I think that was a great move on the trustees' part to make sure that that unfunded liability gets paid throughout the year consistently, regardless of how many hours are actually worked by the ATU members for the district. So that normal cost contribution is paid as $1 per hour for each hour worked. And we were expecting that for the upcoming fiscal year to be about $3.35 an hour. And the amortization payment for the upcoming year to be about $2 million. So that's how we get to the $3.8 million total down there at the bottom. So again, if we just fast forward 2 years, but don't reflect any assumption changes, we are reflecting the asset gains, of course, for the last 2 years. That normal cost contribution is exactly where we expected it to be, just a penny lower there. But that amortization payment is much lower, almost $250,000 lower. And that's reflecting those asset gains. That's what Scott was talking about with being able to basically buy down a lower discount rate, if you want to think of it that way. We're not changing the expected hours, so there's no impact of something like that. But again, as Bill referenced, that really just is reflected in the normal cost contribution. Changing that expected hours assumption has no impact on how quickly you would pay down the unfunded liability. So if we change no assumptions, we would expect the contribution for the fiscal year ending in 2023, so the upcoming fiscal year, to be about $3.5 million, so a little less than we had expected 2 years ago. And just for reference, the contribution for calendar year 2021 was about $3.6 million. So that's right in the range of what we would expect and have seen recently for this plan. So again, the last three columns here are what happens to the contribution after we start changing assumptions. Again, the mortality has a very, very small impact here on both the normal cost and the amortization piece. And so the big change really is coming from that assumed rate of return. As we increase the assumed rate of return, that increases the normal cost. Or sorry, the other way around.
Thanks, guys.
We decrease the assumed rate of return. That increases the normal cost. Those move in opposite directions, just like the liability does. So that increases, I think, about 15 cents an hour for each one of those steps down of 25 basis points. And since the liability also increases with each one of those steps, the amortization piece also increases. So since we have such great returns to kind of pull from, even that 5.5% assumed rate of return still results in a lower expected contribution. It's about, I think, $75,000 lower than if nothing had changed from the valuation 2 years ago, and if we had not seen such excess returns for 2 years. And that fourth column there, the 5.25 assumed return, that is a total increase compared to what we expected of about 80,000. So a modest increase over where we thought we would be at this point. And then the last column, the lowest rate of return we've shown here, the 5%, is about $225,000 higher than we'd expected. So that's, of course, a bigger increase than those other two columns. So the bottom line here is, assuming that our census data comes in roughly where we would expect it to be, given the valuation 2 years ago, that we can lower the assumed rate of return without dramatically increasing the district's expected contribution, which is a great position to be in, really. It does, again, lower the funded percentage, like we talked about a minute ago on the first page of this exhibit, but that is at a lower discount rate, at a more conservative place, basically. So that's still a really good place to be in for the plan. Like Scott mentioned, we're not expecting the trustees to vote and pick any of these assumptions today. We should have final results when we come back at the next meeting. And at that point, then the trustees are the ones responsible for selecting the assumptions that we use in the valuation. And it won't take us long after those have been selected to produce the final valuation and the final contribution rate, since there's probably just a short amount of time there between the next meeting and when this contribution takes effect in July. We want to make sure that the district's finance team has everything that they need to get started on that contribution as soon as it's ready to be paid. So with that, I think we'll take any other questions or can help facilitate any discussion of these assumptions between the trustees.
I know the district's budget keeps getting prepared earlier and earlier every year, so to get a chance to look at these numbers, I think is very helpful for Christina to plan around. You know, the impact of finalizing them, I don't think it will be a large burden for her, but she can speak to that if you had any questions, Christina.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, this is very helpful, as Bill said, because we are right now in the middle of doing our budget planning. And I had one quick question. It's still that our goal is to try to have the plan fully funded within 20 years. Is that correct?
That's correct. So
when you say that, like for all of these that you have here for 2022, those assumptions assume that that if we did this, that it would be funded in 20 years, barring, of course, that we're going to do this again in a and review it in a couple years again and revisit the assumptions. But the goal is always the same.
Right. So that amortization period payment is calculated over a 20-year period. And we can talk more about the details of that calculation because it's a little more complicated than just taking the entire unfunded liability and amortizing for 20 years. It's basically set up in layers from each valuation. So I think the oldest is from the 2006 valuation, the oldest one we have today, which only has 4 more years. It's also one of the largest bases. So that's good news, meaning that in 4 years, that amortization payment, that piece of the amortization payment drops off. Although obviously there's a new base created every time we do a valuation. I think there was also one created when the structure of the plan contribution, or sorry, the plan crediting rates that members earn, when that plan change was made, that was set up as its own base and amortized over a shorter period of time to make sure those plan changes were accurately reflected very quickly and for the plan funding purposes. But yes, any new gains and losses are amortized over a 20-year period. So if everything were to go exactly as we expected over the next 20 years, the plan would be in a fully funded position.
Interesting. And then the other thing, when you showed those different surveys, a couple of them were, I thought, 10 years and a couple were 20 years. So the ones that were 10 years would be slightly higher return, would you say, if they were 20 years instead of 10? Or I just want to make sure I understand, because it looked like the you know, I can't remember the numbers now, but
10-year looked a little bit more pessimistic. And 20 years was optimistic.
Yeah. And I can speak better to the Milliman kind of pair of numbers than to others, but I know, you know, that is driven some by, you know, the fact that currently we've been starting from, for quite a while now, we've been starting from historically high equity prices and historically low interest rates. And both of those things make it hard to see sort of the path for expected long-term higher returns. And if sort of built into the model is some sort of over the next decade, low returns that then as part of those low returns, interest rates may have come up and equity pricing may have come down, then the back half, you're in more of a historical norm for some of those starting points. So that back half ends up being a little higher returns than the front half in that. That reversion to the mean, the period of reverting to the mean is a low return period, and then a little higher in the back half of those periods, usually the way they have those structured. Ian can probably put that in, can weigh in on that too as well if he has something to add.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. You know, all else being equal, valuations that look more attractive and interest rates that were already higher would look better for asset returns going forward. You know, for fixed income, it gets a little different in terms of thinking about it, because from a plan perspective, you want interest rates for your fixed income portfolio to get higher. But you have to remember that the point during that initial increase, that's a painful period, but it sets you up to do better for the long period after that, because you can buy bonds with much higher yields and much higher coupon rates, but you actually lose pricing power as interest rates are increasing in terms of your fixed income portfolio loses money as interest rates are increasing. So under our base case assumption, similar to what Scott's mentioning for Milliman, is that interest rates will increase over the next few years, get us back to some kind of normalized level. So we've got that first couple years built in as a more painful period, but that puts us up to have a better, you know, 15-year period, 18-year period after that, at higher coupon rates. So, and to Scott's point about equities, you know, we've got to see the only way equity valuations look better is under higher interest rates and under probably some kind of equity price decline, which resets valuations looking better on a go-forward basis. So the long and short of it is similar to what Scott's saying is the next 10 years don't look great, but the 20-year horizon could potentially look a little bit better, but the first few years could potentially be more painful. But we've been saying that for, you know, that the industry's been saying that for a number of years now, and equity valuations have continued to climb. So that's not to say that they necessarily can't, or that nobody's got a crystal ball that says the Fed has to increase interest rates. But our base case assumption is those things are becoming every year, becoming more and more likely to happen.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions about this letter? I mean, obviously we're going to get more information at our next meeting, and that's when we'll actually have to make a decision. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, we might be able to have some discussion about where people are feeling comfortable with these numbers. You know, the overall difference in cost is marginal in terms of what we're doing now to what we're doing then. And sometimes you take those opportunities to de-risk and set ourselves up for the future. We did that a couple of years ago. That was a big leap. I don't know if we could take as big of a leap this time around, but you know, taking this down a bit, it just usually means more upfront cash contributions. And that's a little bit more certain than what our assumed rate of return is going to be. So if anybody had any comments on that, open the floor. But you know, I can see the logic of wanting to tick down the assumed rate of return, and you know, generally supportive of that. It puts us on more solid footing. If no other comments, then I guess we can let you guys off the hook for today.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. And yeah, don't hesitate to reach out if there is anything that's helpful in the interim before we come back in May. We want to make sure we're getting you what, or at the next meeting anyway, want to make sure we're getting you what you need for the decision at that point.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. Then our next agenda item is from Mr. Kirtner. It's nothing to report, but anything to report, Jeff?
Still nothing.
Well, that was simple. Appreciate you being here. I know you've been working on other things for the district, and we do appreciate that work as well. So, you know, it's always good. You know, we're hearing a lot of things today from the actuaries, and, you know, one of the things being the mortality assumptions going down, that's just a wide population base issue. But, you know, when we're thinking about that in our industry, I think we've had comparisons in the past that have been quite striking from the front line to the office. And, you know, hopefully we can find ways to continue to move that forward and improve people's lives. But, you know, it's always good to have at least a legal mind listening in on these conversations. Okay. The report of the administrators, they did send out a separate handout with confidential information on it. It just had expenses and retirees from the last meeting. There was one kind of repayment thing in there. I think that was an oddity, but everything else looked normal to me. But do you guys have anything to report otherwise?
No, nothing else other than what was on that. I do like to say I have a whole new appreciation for Sarah and what she does. But hopefully I got it to you guys at least in time. You can look at it before now and let me know if you have any questions.
Yeah. You know, the only other thing that was striking to me about it was I know we've had a lot of retirees, but you know, there is still a lag going until they actually get their payments. So I think tightening up that timeline for our members is something that both of our organizations can work on. And you know, I know LTD wants to get better on that too. So that's the only thing I saw a little striking was just there was only three, and I just know there's been a lot more than that. So, but we'll get there. We'll see a bigger report next time, I'm sure.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, I know that I've probably just before Sarah left for her medical leave, I had reviewed probably four or five calculations she did. So those are probably all showing up on the next one.
Okay, any questions for Dean? Seeing none and hearing none, move on to our standing agenda item of the COLA. And, you know, just I'll say, honestly, there hasn't been any work done. I think we've ticked back on our progress on the COLA front. We will be heading into bargaining with the district, and I'm sure at some point in time that'll come up. But, you know, just watch the news, and I get a lot of feedback from the members that are part of this plan, and they're very concerned about what's happening with inflation. So we've had a lot of discussion about inflation today. You know, the last time we did a real check-in on what retirement has been for our members in the last 20 years, you know, if they hadn't gotten a COLA since 2006, back in 2018, we said their buying power was 20% less. I can only imagine what it is now. We're probably 30% less now, you know, with the way inflation's been going the last couple of years. And that's something that, you know, we just need to do better on. And I think that's something we got to keep in our minds as we're moving forward, as we're planning this retirement for our folks. And there's a reason why this is a standing agenda item, but the pandemic has made it hard to make progress and get people in one room and figure it out. So that's on us to do. So with that, I just would ask the trustees if there was any new or unfinished business that wasn't listed. And if I don't see anything, we're going to move on to making the schedule for the next one. So I'm not seeing any hands or heads. So we're going to move on to making the schedule. I'm going to always lead it to Ian to kind of lead us down the path of what works best for reporting purposes.
Yeah, Bill, I think, you know, usually we target, you know, mid-May. So, you know, probably earliest date we could start thinking about is sometime in that week of the 9th, 13th. But could certainly do after that as well. But that's probably the earliest spot we'd want to grab a date.
Okay. We've kind of been shifting on our day of the week. We've been avoiding Wednesdays. I think that's a board meeting. Sometimes we ran into conflicts with LTD board meetings on Wednesday, so we've been avoiding that. So a Tuesday or Thursday, either the 10th or 12th. How's that looking for folks?
The 10th works well for me.
12th works better for me, but I could make them both work.
They both work for me, Bill.
Both work for me as well.
All right. How's the 11 o'clock start time feel for folks? Works for me. I can just keep it rolling.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So we're looking in at May 10th at 11.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
That works on our end.
Okay, good. That's important as well that we have open air. So thank you for letting us know that, Camille. Michelle, how'd that work for you? I didn't get a chance to hear you.
That works just fine for me, thanks.
Okay. And I guess we'll continue with pandemic protocols until otherwise changed. So we'll assume it's Zoom for that meeting. Would love to see y'all again in person and have a good chat over a lunch, but you know, we'll make it work until then. Okay, so with that set, I'll hand the keys over to Christina and she can run the next meeting. But it was good seeing everybody today. Good to hear good news and things to think about in the interim. So thanks everybody for your participation.
Thank you so much, Bill. All right, so we are starting the meeting of the Pension Trust for the Salaried Employees Retirement Plan. And I will start with roll call, which is just myself, Mark Johnson, and Michelle Weber. So I am here, Christina Hsu, and Michelle.
Here.
And I think Mark must have dropped off, but we can just move forward. And the next thing is just to review. Michelle, have you had a chance to review the last minutes to the meeting?
I have not.
Okay. Well, we'll make a hold then before we move forward on that, which normally what we do is we review those and we would make a motion to accept the minutes or not, but we can not do that today and we can do that at the next meeting. I would have done the audience participation, but I don't see any audience. So I don't think I think we could skip that one unless Camille tells me I can't.
Nope, you can go ahead and skip it. There are no public attendees today.
Okay, perfect. And then moving on for the next item is items for the investment consultant, which usually Ian just highlights anything that's different from what we had from the meeting, the ATU meeting where he presented all of the results of that portfolio. Ian, I'm going to hand the meeting to you.
All right. I'll just highlight, obviously, capital markets comments are consistent between both. I'll highlight here that, you know, we've got a slight difference in asset allocation between the two plans. So the investment returns are a bit different. You know, that being said, the story is largely the same. You know, we had another great year on the, as you can see on the page. The gain for the year was right about $2.6 million. As a reminder, that's on the heels of about a $3 million gain that we had the year prior. So, you know, up a solid $5.5 million over the past 2 years. So that sets us right at about just sub $26 million for this plan. So again, really strong couple years. If you can see here, I'll focus on the net of fees page here, but calendar year to date return for this plan was also just right above 11%, outperformed the policy benchmark by 50 basis points. And also, I guess I'll back up a couple page ranked above peers as well. And then obviously, since the construction of the underlying composites is exactly the same, but just the weightings to those composites is slightly different than the ATU plan, that affects total fund performance, but the composite comments are the same or applicable to the same degree as we talked about in ATU. So long story short, another great year from an asset returns perspective, well above investment return assumptions for both of those years. And if you can look out till, you know, even out 10 years, you know, we're annualized right at about 9% net of fees. So really strong last 10 years performances, continue to put this plan in a better and better funding position. So Christina, I think unless there's specific comments that anybody has, that would probably end my prepared remarks for this plan.
Thank you as always, Ian, appreciate it. Michelle, do you have any questions or comments or anybody else?
I don't have any. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. So then we can move to the next, which is anything from Scott, the actuary?
Nothing to report today.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Jeff, anything from the attorney's perspective?
Also nothing for today.
All right. The last is Dean, with regards to the administrator's report. Do you have any comments that you want to share with regards to the document that you sent out with the payments that have been made against the administrative plan?
No comments. The expenses were pretty much in line with the ordinary expenses the plan is paying. We had one new pension this time.
Yep, I saw that. Any questions that anybody has? No? All right. So any additional business people want to talk about or discuss that we haven't done? If not, the next meeting is the one that will be held on May 10th. It will be just like this one, where it just follows on to the ATU meeting. And if no one has anything else that they want to cover, we can adjourn. Does anybody have anything, last minute things? No? All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for being here. And I appreciate your time and your care for taking care of our admin pension plan. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Christina. Thanks, Christina.
Bye.
Bye.